Cool.
Okay, this is Greg Felbury. I'm the research director at the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. We're here with Professor Anthony Sanders. I was just saying the commission was created by Congress to investigate the causes of the financial crisis. There's a list of 23 things we're supposed to investigate, many of which I think you've got some expertise in.
Mm-hmm.
We also are supposed to do case studies, and hold hearings. So we've had a couple of hearings already. We've done case studies on Citigroup. We're working on some other companies, rating agencies, to try to get to the root of the crisis, and we are required to report back to Congress in December. So that's where we are. We have four or five more hearings planned. The next one will be about credit rating agencies, and then a month after that, we have one on derivatives. We also have ones planned on excess leverage and too big to fail, for example. So that's in short where we are. Maybe I could go around the room and have everybody introduce themselves.
Hi, I'm Tom Green.
Jane Cullen.
Kim Schiff.
Yeah, Randall Dodd.
Now that I know absolutely nothing about you.
So I have a structured products background. I was at Bear Stearns, and was senior managing director.
Cool. Did one also confess?
Oh, well, I'm an economist, but I've been working in primarily in the area of financial market regulation at the CFTC, at the International Monetary Fund, and then I ran a nonprofit called the Financial Policy Forum that worked on these issues for about 7 years.
CPA, technical accounting person.
And I'm an attorney. I've been helping them with their document requests and various demands for data.
And I'm actually a detailee from the Fed, and I'm in banking supervision.
Excellent.
Jane was shy, but she's a detailee from the SEC.
Yes.
So if you could start just by telling us about your background. I guess we did invite you specifically because we have a derivatives hearing and we've read some stuff of yours, but I've got two of your papers and I'm very interested in what you're saying about CDOs and regulatory capital arbitrage. There's a lot of topics I think we could talk about. But if you could just start by your background and your interests and research, and we can just kind of take it from there.
Again, it was the usual for an economist, a finance professor, a PhD, taught at the Ohio State University, University of Chicago, the Graduate School of Business, until 1997, worked at Deutsche Bank from 97 to 2000, interspersed in there was Merrill Lynch doing their pricing models. A brief stint at a firm I don't want to talk about since they were just in the news. Didn't like the environment.
That's the
ones we do want to
talk about. That was too much work. Work you like a dog. But then also to study this topic, basically securitization, mortgage backed securities, banking, underwriting, etc. From afar.
So you've been at George Mason since 2000?
Yeah, just about 10 months. No, just 10 months. Just 10 months.
Oh, just 10 months. So between 2000 and 2009 you were...
No, I was at Ohio State and tried Arizona State for 2 years till the economy completely collapsed. Besides, couldn't stand Arizona in the first place, so moved here.
So you're at the Mercatus Institute as well?
Yes, I'm a senior scholar. Well, sort of. I'm a senior scholar there, but I'm not even sure where it is.
Okay.
So, I mean, we like to start off just by saying, how do you think, or what role do you think derivatives played in causing the financial crisis?
To be quite blunt with you, let's start off with the simple answer. If I had a yes or no, I would say no. This wasn't derivatives at all. That's a good straw man to set up for the attack, but I'll be glad to even give you, you probably had not looked at my House testimonies recently, and I don't blame you, it's pretty dull, but I will tell you, let's set up the problem, if you don't mind, let me take a second.
Yeah.
I think the problem comes along, is that, and in fact I'll even send you my House testimony with all the graphics, the gory graphics. In short, what we did was, let's start off. The government has been pushing home ownership for decades. Tax subsidies, we've really skewed it towards, you know, own. Mm-hmm. Programs all over the place in the federal, state, and local government. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac then jumped in and, along with the FHLBs, Federal Home Loan Bank System, and mm-hmm. pumped essentially $8 trillion worth of debt and guarantees into the financial system since 1997. A little bit less than that. They're already doing some of that. In fact, I have a graph showing that in one of my testimonies, that the big house price bubble, hard to take notes when I'm gesturing with my fingers, but the big house price bubble, mm-hmm. oddly, looks exactly like the amount of debt and guarantees that Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae and the FHLBs were all issuing. Now, again, that's a social good on the one hand, which has turned into a social bad, meaning that, in part, the government has to take some responsibility, whether it's failure to regulate properly, failure to monitor. Mm-hmm. Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae are probably doing what they thought they were supposed to be doing, providing liquidity to banks. Mm-hmm. The banks are doing what banks do, which is make loans. But then the problem, there's nobody saying, at one point we have to shut the spigot off. You can't just pump trillions into a market and not expect an asset bubble. Bubble hits, finally bubble taps out, crash. And then we blame it on derivatives. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I'm saying there's a bigger picture here. And again, this is not assigning blame to Fannie or Freddie. It's not assigning blame to the banks. It's just simply saying we had a social project, which is to increase home ownership. But again, admirable goal. The problem is that A, it really didn't. We already were kind of hit the peak of home ownership rates. All we did was double housing prices, mm-hmm. which again is a social good if you happen to own a home, and it's a social bad mm-hmm. if you are on the downside of that crash. Mm-hmm. So the derivatives contribute to it. Yeah, there's a contributing factor, absolutely. Mm-hmm. But that's, again, that's missing the bigger issue, and I think and that's always been my concern, even at the House hearings, is that we. Of course, it's government interviewing me, so they're not willing to say it's us. But again, noteworthy, I'm a big multifamily housing mm-hmm. fan, mm-hmm. and I don't know why we have not been pushing multifamily more, and we would not have had an asset bubble. But having said that, let's go back.
Sometimes we distinguish between causes and propagating mechanisms. So if you reject that derivatives is a cause or is a primary cause, when you say it contributed, would you embrace the term propagating mechanism, or do you mean something different?
A propagating mechanism would be a good way to describe it.
Are you going to speak to your ideas on the spigot, like who, what would have been the shutoff?
Absolutely.
Shutting off the spigot.
In fact, I can even, if I was just telling me I'm supposed to be testifying, I apologize for that. Yeah, I even have a graphic, which, again, I'll send you all the stuff back up.
Great.
There's a point at about 2002, 2003, where, whether it's Alan Greenspan, whoever, the Fed should have stepped in and just said, wait a minute, we're going to overheat this, and basically, you know, slow down the system. Either Fannie and Freddie's regulators, if there actually were one, effective regulator, was non-existent. Let's just put our cards on the table since we're all friends here. Home ownership is a very popular issue, and whether it's Republicans or Democrats, that's a tough one to slow down. When the party's going on, who's going to be the one that says, you have to drive? Everyone wanted to keep the party going. The Bush administration, Congress could have, the Fed, all could have stepped in about 2003 and said, whoops, it's starting to heat. Let's slow it down. Greenspan said he felt he didn't have any authority to try to slow down the housing market, although he felt he had the authority to slow down the stock market. Don't understand that parity, but we just had a big party going on, and the Fed, Treasury, all could have intervened in a positive fashion and slowed it down. But they didn't. And it was about 2002, 2003.
So these aren't causes that we're examining as well.
Yeah.
I mean, we had Fannie Mae testify two months ago, and we did an investigation leading up to that, and we're not ignoring the role of the GSEs. And I'm not sure we're required by the Congress to rank order causes in our emphasis, but to the extent that derivatives contributed, can you help us kind of through the arguments and where people are making them, where you think maybe the people are exaggerating or not?
Okay, let's start off with the most obvious one that was just in the news recently, the credit default swaps. Mm-hmm. Credit default swaps are, in fact, I testified in the Kanjorski hearings in the House on Greece, and credit default swaps contribute to it. And the answer I gave is the same one, I'm sure if you worked at Barry, you know who Daryl Duffy is from Stanford University. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're all in agreement. It was not the CDS that caused Greece's problem. Greece's problem was caused by two things: excessive debt compared to GDP and taxing sources of revenues, and B, hiding their debt. And once the debt became known, credit default swaps snapped up, which means that, to me, they're the perfect mechanism to be able to gather information on the market, because on a trading desk, if you try to rely on bond yields don't reflect instantly this type of information. Mm-hmm. They're laggy, they're noisy, whereas the default swaps, again, when I worked on the desk, I would check swaps the second I walked in the morning. First thing I'd look at, because those are the fastest indicators of any noise in the market. And sometimes too much noise. Sometimes there's overreaction. But that's okay, but it tells me there's a market signal out there that I'm not getting.
Why are they so much faster?
Because it's a traded market, and it's two parties willing to basically buy and sell insurance on a particular type of risk. Mm-hmm. And so it's very, very rapid. It's a small percentage of all the derivatives contracts compared to what we think, like interest rate derivatives, but they're highly reactive. Whereas the bond yield sometimes, as we know, if you get away from U.S. on the run, even get off the run treasuries in the U.S., they're very sticky, slow, the information is not conveyed properly. Go to corporate bond yields and bank bonds, forget it. Those things sometimes can go months without trading. So the CDS are really, again, I call it reactive, meaning they process information very rapidly.
And so the volume of trading in CDS is great, is more than other OTC derivatives.
Yes.
Secondary trading.
Yeah, but what I'm saying compared to interest rate derivatives.
Right, like right.
Fannie and Freddie have been doing those forever. And there was always the fear, like I wrote about this in Reuters back in 2001, saying Freddie and Fannie are so gigantic, but they're very active participants in the interest rate swap models. But if one of those counterparties ever goes bad, this could be a real chain reaction and a real bad problem. And, of course, nothing happened until 2007. And then Freddie and Fannie defaulted on their CDS, as we know. So it wasn't CDS. These are just, again, bets, insurance, if you want to call it. Not gambling. They're actually insurance contracts. And so I think they actually serve a public purpose in the sense that they provide information. And they allow firms to hedge against downside risk. I know what your next question is going to be. Or at least if I was sitting there, what I would ask, are naked positions bad? Of course not. I think they're a good thing. I certainly took them. Why would I take naked positions? Once again, I have a portfolio. In the abstract, if we look at securities on a one-to-one basis, you get a misleading and a kind of an alarmist view of what goes on a trading desk. I may take a position that's unrelated to other securities in my portfolio simply because there's a risk out there that I think may hit my securities, and I want to take a cover myself on the downside. So it may look unrelated to the rest of my securities, but it's just me trying to price a risk that I'm not measuring adequately in my portfolio.
Okay. So, I guess, the two kind of broad stories that we're looking at when it comes to derivatives, and one is kind of tied up in CDOs, but it's the question of to what extent synthetic CDOs and derivatives and other things contributed to the MBS market getting out of hand. And your paper, which I haven't devoted enough time to,
Market Implosion?
Seems to address that question. So one thing is to say that they happened at the same time, but the other question is where can you describe the causality?
I have another paper which I'll send you today. Mm-hmm. It's a paper we did for the Bond Market Association, and when they read it, they fired us.
Who's that?
The bond. I mean, it was going back a few years. Then
yeah,
it was the bond market.
It was right. That's what I mean. It was going back. This is when it was peaking. It was in about whatever, and we wrote a paper. I'll leave the "we" off of it since it's been terminated. I still have it. Mm-hmm. But what it was looking at how the rating agencies are rating CEOs, and our conclusion was, there's no way on earth the rating agencies have any clue what they're doing here. Copula models. And they can hire mathematicians from Brown University all they want. They're substituting in sophisticated models of diversification for looking at collateral buckets. And collateral is all that mattered in these things. And since they weren't looking at the, and again, there's reasons for that, but since they underlooked at the collateral buckets, they based most of their analysis on historical. And again, I got great graphics for this, but during the subprime crisis, housing prices are doing this, subprime delinquencies are actually declining. Then all of a sudden, when it does this, you get a massive fall off the cliff. Mm-hmm. And so on CDOs, let's start off.
First, can I formally request a copy of your paper?
Sure. And what year was it published?
It wasn't.
Oh.
It was taken off the table.
So this is a draft?
It's a draft.
Okay. When was it, though?
2005.
So the Bond Market Association...
Well, fires is a strong word. They just said, we don't want to fund this.
Yeah, they contracted with you, and then
yes,
they saw your preliminary results and said, I'm sorry, we're not writing the check.
Well, again, there's a lot of people from the rating agencies were on the project, and they went, we don't like what you're saying. And I said, I don't blame you.
Do you know Josh Rosner? Was he involved with your...
No, that's not Rosner.
Okay.
Wow. Oh, there he is.
There he is. I'm sitting in here.
Great.
That's fascinating. Who did you talk to at the MBA who might tell us more about this?
Bond Market Association.
Yeah.
Bond
Market Association.
I'm sorry. They're all gone. Nobody's there anymore.
It's simple now, right?
Yeah. Yep. But nobody's there.
Yeah, but they merged a few years ago.
Yeah. They're all history.
And you said, who did you deal with at the rating agencies?
I'm not going to talk to you. I'm not going to mention that. Sorry.
Okay.
Now, this is, again, confidential. Someone you know, but I won't put it, but we were hired by the Bond Market Association to study CDOs.
Mm, okay.
And they saw a preliminary draft and killed it. So this is a very touchy subject. But I have the draft. Sam's my co-author's name. But I'll be glad to give you.
That's fascinating. So do you think a lot of people were saying this at the time? Or did you feel it was really an unusual point of view?
You know, on the way up, anything goes. On the way down, nothing goes. Meaning that we're discussing the rating agencies using, and I've dealt with rating agencies, mm-hmm, reverse engineering their models, which are generally much more simplistic than anything you're using.
Mm-hmm.
You just submit a couple of deals, you know exactly what the ratings are doing. On CDOs, they're substituting in highly sophisticated copula models, etc., for analyzing the risk of CDOs, and missing the entire point that the collateral buckets were using historical data and weren't conveying the proper information. So we waltzed ourselves into what eventually happened.
Hmm. So was there a point where a decision was made to use that sort of model as opposed to one that focused on the quality of the collateral? I mean, it seems like such a basic misstep, but...
Again, the rating agencies serve a purpose, but their purpose is not going to be prognostication. They're not particularly good at that.
No.
Yeah. No, they're very historically based. Mm-hmm. They actually follow Alan Greenspan. I look at the data, And the data during the time when the CDOs were hot and then died, the data was saying everything is beautiful. Defaults are falling on subprime. What's not to like? Now, somebody had to have a model of housing. When housing does this, it all blows up. Now, we didn't know, and again, I'll say this with a straight face. The housing market did this, and then this. I don't think a lot of people anticipated that, the latter part, the drop off the cliff. Mm-hmm. That was kind of a stunner. So did people realize there was a problem in the housing market? Yeah, sure, there's risk. I think that was an outlier that a lot of... I don't think Fannie and Freddie actually saw it coming either. And they're the biggest purveyors of databases and understanding of housing markets on the earth. It's a fairly safe assumption. And I don't want to know what they knew when and what, but...
Some of us do.
And I remember talking to somebody with the initials of FN when he said there's no housing bubble. And I was saying, are you kidding me? What do you call this? But that was the party line. But on the CDO front, it was very clear that, again, as long as...
Was that the party line meaning he knew better, or that was the party line he wasn't going to ask?
Wasn't going to ask.
Thank you.
And who knows what they're actually doing on the modeling side. Yeah. But going forward, though, again, if you look at that subprime defaults falling or flattening out as housing prices are doing this, if you're totally based on historical housing prices, you can't get a lot of traction out of using historical models. So they substituted in all these sophisticated copulas, you know, Gaussian functions to sit there and say, ooh, these are diversified. And it turns out ex post, how much diversification was there? Zero. They all moved in a systematic risk. It's a staggering. And end of story. But again, as soon as the subprime spiked, the market demand for CDOs fell off the cliff. Number one, and that's even for generics, cash CDOs. When we're starting to go into the synthetic CDOs, all the rest is history.
Did the synthetic CDOs
stimulate... Yeah, we want to unpack that.
Did the synthetic CDOs in any way stimulate or support origination of subprime mortgages?
Or continue to sustain subprime origination, therefore continue to sustain the bubble? And
I would say the following. I would say no, for the following reason. I was waiting for someone to slap me for saying that, but I actually don't believe it. Now, the answer is the following. If you take a look at what databases the people playing in this market had, whether it's Bear Stearns, Goldman, Deutsche, any company, all have access to loan performance, derivative solutions, all these phenomenal databases covering asset-backed securities.
What was the second one?
Derivative solutions is a tool that traders use, but it gives them up-to-date information on derivative behavior. It has many competitors for it, but it's something we would use to go through and price derivatives. But again, between loan performance, what is now McDash and LPS and all these other systems, we had a good idea what the risks were in the subprime market. Those were not really disclosed. I think as the market saw the subprime softening, I think fear jumped in, risk. And then when it fell off, I think then the whole demand for all this went.
And do you time that to second half of 06 or earlier, or later?
Oh, actually, there's two events, second half of 06, then second half of 07. One was the initial spill, but 07 was the more serious problem. I'd say 06 is a warning sign. But again, there's people all over the place saying, don't worry, don't worry. 07 was the, I think October of 07 was probably the trigger event.
So the warning signs in 06 would have been house prices were actually going down.
Yeah, they're starting to slow down. Depending, and again, if you break up the indices into regional and national, the national indices were starting to either slow, just kind of just past the peak. But again, in defense of everybody, you can have it do this. It can flatline for a while and go back up. It doesn't mean it's going to fall off a cliff. I think when they started getting evidence, particularly from the Southwest, from Arizona, California, Nevada, that in fact housing prices were starting to seriously decline. Mm-hmm. They were first along with Florida, and then
they were first to fall.
Yeah, they were the first to really have the huge fall. Mm-hmm. And that, and since, and again, if you look at the origination data on subprime and all A's, that's where the lion's share of it was, the Southwest Florida. And so as the alt A's started to blow up, I'm sure Alan remembers this, we were told the story that alt A's really are just no different than prime mortgages. They're just, now I never believed that for a second. I always knew these things were going to be a terrible moral hazard problem. Mm-hmm. But I was gone by that time. But as the housing prices started falling seriously, then it became obvious that alt A's were going to be a serious problem, so were subprimes. But I have it, it's in that paper I did in Journal of Housing Economics, where I showed the breakpoints in the Southwest. And that I'll send you that as well.
Yeah.
But that corresponds with exactly when the CDO market just blew up. Mm-hmm.
So why are synthetic CDOs not... You're saying synthetic CDO is not a big deal. Is that because of your view on naked CDS?
I would say they're not a big deal because, once again, there is a derivative on the underlying securities.
They're just like a naked CDS, but yeah, separate entity.
Yeah, but again, you can create synthetic positions for anything. You can take any security and create a synthetic security from it. I think this gets ballyhooed because the CDO market collapsed, because the subprimes collapsed. I think we wouldn't even be talking about this had the CDO market not blown up. I just don't see where the synthetics were really any better or worse, other than the fact that transparency. Now, the one thing I do blame the crisis on, partly on, is the complete lack of transparency. Mm-hmm. You can see the collateral. That's why, again, I think those are always disingenuous statements by people suing, let's say, Goldman or Morgan Stanley, to saying there's no transparency. Well, there's two levels of transparency. First, again, as I said, subprime, alt-A, all that data is almost real-time. You can see how bad that stuff's performing. Once a month it comes out, and you can see it. So there's no excuse for not marking the trends in that market. I have no sympathy for those people that bought that stuff, and then because they had the same data that, in a sense, Goldman had. The other problem, and this is where I take off my defense hat, and I'll put on my, not litigation hat, but transparency. The CDO market is fine on the surface. The problem CDOs had, is the infamous problem with CDO squares. CDOs of CDOs. Now, as you're all aware, I'm speaking to the choir, in a CDO transaction, if Tom here and I, if I'm at Deutsche and he's at CalPERS, let's suppose we're only we get to observe what's in the collateral for the transaction. The rating agencies, the two of us. Since there's no trade exchange, we don't all get to observe the information. So only we look at it. And the problem with that is that means there's two sets of eyes in the rating agencies. Assume for now the rating agencies contribute zero at best. Mm-hmm. At worst, I would say their naivete for trying to compete in this market probably caused some damage, if you relied on them at all. But I don't think sophisticated investors, if you're at Barry, you don't rely on Moody's or S&P. I don't think anybody does, other than maybe small pension funds, etc. But having said that, if you look at a CDO transaction, I tried myself, along with someone else, to get the collateral buckets for some CDOs in the market. You can't. You cannot get them.
Now, that would have been in Moody's database, right?
You were trying to get the offering circulars and get a hold of, I mean, concretely, that's what you were saying.
Yes.
You're trying to get either the offering circulars or trustee reports.
Yeah,
or
something.
Then you could not, because it was all 144A.
That's right. And so you can't get them. And then once you get, like, for example, when they held the Goldman hearings, mm-hmm. hallelujah, I finally got to see some of the CDO flip books.
What about the loan tapes? Aren't those provided?
Now you're in mortgage land. Yep. CDO
Now remember, this is a transparency issue. Right. She's absolutely right. In mortgage land, we have all the data we could choke ourselves with.
Is that true if I buy a AAA private label security? Not a CDO, but just a simple AAA.
All that data is available.
So I get that. I can monitor that. I don't need to rely on the rating agency.
No, in fact, I was just down at George Washington teaching Van Orders class on monitoring subprime MBS. You pull up Bloomberg, which is the worst of all of them, and you get everything literally there. You don't actually have the loan tapes, but you can get, again, Loan Performance, McDash, Black Box, I think it's now out of Bethesda, are all doing the same thing. You get every bit of information on the MBS and ABS.
Could you have done that several years ago?
Yes, absolutely.
Thank you.
That's a myth that information exists.
You have to pay for it. Oh, yes. So that you have to have either a certain level of sophistication or a certain amount of assets under management to be able to have the economics to support purchasing that data.
You are correct. It's cost prohibitive. It's very, very expensive to get loan performance. In fact, in Washington, I think, Fannie, Freddie, the Treasury, et cetera, all have it. But if you're a small, let's say you're state teachers, retirement system to Ohio, they're not supposed to be in this market, but because they can't afford to have loan performance, and they wouldn't know what to do with it if they had it. Now, why didn't a third party step in and provide information? Well, they do. But apparently, if you bought the AAA part of a subprime deal, you may have been able to. You got the Moody's stamp of approval, opened up pension funds to buying the stuff, which I still can't comprehend. They should have AAA prime or something, meaning that if it still says subprime, you shouldn't buy it.
But the rating agencies screwed up in 2003 on manufactured housing loans and their AAA rating of stuff that went south dramatically.
Yes.
Was that a lesson for the market that you better do your own due diligence, or was it reasonable for people to go on and say, well, that was a peculiar asset, we don't need to worry about that?
Andy Davidson and I, in our book, Securitization, have a whole chapter devoted towards the manufactured housing crisis. And basically, what Alan's referring to is we have a list of all the firms in doing asset-backed or manufactured housing loans 1 year, and then 2 years later, they're all gone. And it took down Conseco with them.
Yep.
And what did we learn from that? Apparently nothing. It's the same crisis, only smaller in scale. We loan money to very credit-sensitive households, and then when the market got soft, the market blew up.
Did they tranche it out in a comparable one?
Oh, not to the extent we tranched it out this time. But yeah,
manufactured housing was also a piece of what went into multi-sector CDOs,
yes,
which also blew up because the underlying collateral blew up.
Again, it's all underlying collateral, and it's the extent that the market couldn't identify the risk of the underlying collateral. I think it's, whether it's cash CDOs, whether it's synthetic CDOs, it's all the fact that transparency started getting narrower and narrower for the underlying collateral. And when you go to CDO squares and synthetics, truly the...
Sorry.
No? I'm just glad that was you and not me.
So that's your argument in this price discovery process between the CDO and the MBS market.
is that the lack of transparency through the creation of CDO meant that the market was mispricing the risk, and that was somehow transmitted back into the MBS space?
Yes, there's a transmission mechanism there. However, I just want to go on record as saying that when I was watching the Goldman's hearings with great fascination, and I was very happy they sent me the entire document stack, so I got to look at all the big question rose in my mind as I was reading it and saying, you know, for how much you want to call Goldman, whatever you want to call them, for those CDO transactions, one question rises up. If I can look at those pitch books, which were clearly laid out, and I just looked at three pitch books, and I saw problems. Ex ante. I would have looked and said, why did people buy those when you could clearly see there was lack of information about the underlying collateral? Buyer beware. I mean, people didn't have to buy Goldman's products. Why did they buy them?
Well, when I came to...
Okay, I know. This is much further deeper than that.
The only buyer was IKB, and it seems that they were just pushing it into a sieve, so they were looking at themselves as a market maker or whatever, mm-hmm. rather than an investor, too.
Mm-hmm.
I did something interesting this morning with the database that we just got our hands on, which is I took a different Abacus deal, which was Abacus 2006-12
mm-hmm.
From April 06. And using this database, I looked for each tranche, and every single tranche was in another CDO.
Mm-hmm.
There was no real money buyer of the whole CDO. I get the sense that was really the rule rather than the exception, but we need to do a little bit of work on that.
I mean, rule for what?
That between the super senior tranche, which was going, we know, monolines and banks and whatever, and the equity tranche, which was going to Magnetar and hedge funds, all the tranches in between were largely going to other CDOs. I mean, the CDO market was what's the word? it was buying the bulk of its own tranches.
Well, because you convert them into either equity or super senior by doing a CDO squared. So what you're sort of saying is it's the intermediate range yield risk return that was harder to place in the market. People wanted equity risk, they wanted AAA risk, they didn't want... 1A mezzanine. Thank you. Right. And so that's what you had to restructure into.
So what you were buying wasn't even a CDO squared. It probably was. I think she said in her paper, it was on average, it was a CDO to the sixth.
Oh,
sixth.
Well, CDOs had maybe 5% limitations of sort of miscellaneous stuff you could put in there. Mm-hmm. So if each ABS CDO mm-hmm. could buy 5% of its collateral of some other mm-hmm. CDO, the interconnections between mm-hmm. the deals became significant.
Tony, there were a number of instances where big institutions held on to the AAA piece of a CDO
mm-hmm.
because it couldn't sell it at a reasonable price.
Mm-hmm.
What was going on there? In other words, if I'm doing the whole deal, I've got to price the whole deal. And if I end up selling out all of the lower stuff but keeping the bigger stuff because nobody wants to give me a reasonable price, is it reasonable to ask the question, you know, what's this whole deal worth to me in fact?
The way I would put that is the following, is that... when you take, and again, I want to address a question you did so I can feedback here. When CDO started out, you could have these, you know, multiple layered tranches in the core assets, which is subprime. And then as you mix and match and try to create various risk reward tranches, going from equity up to AAA super senior, then you got a bunch of stuff in the middle. The middle stuff is actually fine, although that's misleading. Because even back when markets are good, those middle-level risk tranches are always their fight to sell on the desk. Everyone either wants AAA because the pension funds or the equity. Everyone wants the low risk. Middle risk has always been kind of dicey to get rid of. But after the market kind of started showing weaknesses and falling apart, yeah, you're right, the demand for the middle stuff went to zero because no one knew what the middle stuff was. We had no idea how the collateral was going to perform on it. So the market has bifurcated into kind of super, super senior versus equity. And so a lot of these tranches they were mixing and matching were just kind of clever ways of just separating the market into basically two types of claims, is the way I would look at it. Mm-hmm. But having said that, I was mystified at first when I looked at Goldman's CDO tranching as well, between Abacus and all the other ones. But and you notice that there's the same unobservable asset was in all the deals. You see that? Yeah, there were CDO deals that showed up in each of the deals, and those were not transparent. But again, why did you, we'll take away just the specific case of Goldman and how they're funneling the deals. Mm-hmm. Do I care that the private market can't observe that? If this was actually other companies jumping in and buying this stuff, if CDOs, synthetics were in each deal that Goldman was doing, is that necessarily a problem? No. It just means that if you bought a portfolio of Goldman CDOs, synthetic or cash, but let's just say they're synthetic, for the idea of diversification, going back to Moody's thing, you're out of luck. It's not going to be diversified at all. That's it. But again, why was the market buying unobservable securities? That's really the more interesting question. And I was over in Europe giving a presentation to BNP Paribas, who's a big investor in all these securities. And as I was showing the house prices and the default rates and all this, they were almost ready to lynch me, saying, "Why did you do this to us?" And I went, No, here's the data you have, I have. Why did, of course they're paying for me business class over this, I couldn't be too offensive. But I said, you bought this here knowing that there was a chance this was going to happen. It happened. What's the problem? You bought this with open eyes. Now, but why would you buy non-transparent CDOs, particularly the, and I never have a spread. And then when that spread game collapsed, you then get back to Tom's question. When it started to unravel, there was no place to hide. Because once it was revealed that the collateral turned out ex post to be far more risky than thought, meaning that we were getting the signal that this was really a crash, I think the market for non-transparent, thinly traded securities went. So you couldn't even get rid of AAA. Or AAA anymore? The answer is, of course not. AAA is probably now could even be C. Mm-hmm. So there's no, and again, liquidity also dried up in the markets. You need liquidity for the CDO market to actually transact. Liquidity died. And so Citi is sitting on, well, you already know this. Citi's sitting on a whole nation worth of CDOs they can't get rid of. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think this is an example of, again, just back up one step. When markets are heating up in a bubble, everything looks good because there's plenty of liquidity and no one foresees the problem. The first things to get knocked out are non-transparent securities, particularly on something subprime, was called subprime for a reason. It's a higher risk category that was non-transparent in the CDO world. Now, again, transparency, I think, would have solved a whole multitude of these problems. We would not be sitting here today if there was actually transparency.
Just to explore, you're saying that there is transparency, that, or at least there could be purchased data to make transparent what was happening in the subprime mortgage market. So why doesn't that translate, in your view, to an understanding of what's going to happen with mezzanine ABS CDOs, whether cash or synthetic?
That's a good question, and the answer is the following. Supposing that I want to look at, as an independent bystander, I have models of subprime losses, all A losses. I've got all the data. It's just a matter of my assumption on house prices, default severities, the usual lineup of suspects. And then I want to look at a CDO. When I look at a CDO, I don't have access to any of these CDO data. Because why? there are transactions between two parties. Only they have access to it. And Moody's. Moody's would not give up the data. And I understand that. Mm-hmm. But I can't get access to information, so I don't know what those two are transacting at. Does one of them have an advantage in the information and not the other? I don't know. Can't observe it. Mm-hmm. So you can't go through and really measure what the risk of the CDOs are. Just the two parties can. Let's add then CDO squares on top of that. CDOs of CDOs. Non-transparent securities of non-transparent securities.
Let me push the argument.
All right, go ahead.
Which I want to do respectfully. But if the data on subprime in 06 is showing that delinquencies and therefore expected defaults are going to eat into the returns on the triple B tranches of subprime, then why didn't people say, even though I don't know which securities are in my CDOs, why didn't people then say, oh, triple B subprime is really a problem, that means triple A mezzanine CDOs are very much threatened as well?
Actually, I think they did. Because that's the paper I gave you. It said once the realization, you couldn't identify specifically in the market which tranche was going to behave exactly how, but you had a global signal saying, is this market deteriorating? We can't observe the actual details, but we know at the global level the market's deteriorating quickly. And since, again, that's my point of transparency, then the whole thing froze up because it would probably have frozen up anyway. Even if you had detailed CDO specifics, because the subprime market tanked like that. But the point is that having the transparency created a little extra juice that helped a little of the freeze up. But again, this probably would have, like you saw the Nomura deal, it was in the paper I wrote called Securitization After the Fall. It's something out of the New York Times, actually. This showed how a AAA Nomura subprime deal became like all C's and D's. And again, they make it look, it's the New York Times, they make it look like it's the most dastardly thing they ever saw in their life. It's very easy. The collateral, not to paraphrase President Clinton, but it's the collateral, stupid. I mean, as the housing market declined, the whole thing blew up. And even if you had great transparency, it would have blown up anyway. CDO squares didn't help. But again, I would argue that's a risk that certain investors took on. That, you know, maybe they ex post shouldn't have, but that's their call.
So let's talk about the rating agencies that have all this information. Mm-hmm. You had a warning in late 06. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't that cast at least a little shadow on giving a positive rating to say that subprime market wasn't generating like it used to at that point? But the synthetics, wouldn't the rating agency at least be a little more cautious about rating a synthetic at that point?
One would think. Now, we have a study. Am I wrong? Good, I just want to make a double check on this. We have a study that I don't think we've... Not Saatchi, I'm not looking at him. We have a study, it was for a court case, where we looked at the ratings changes as the market was falling apart. Mm-hmm. And the, as you know, you've probably seen independent studies of this. The number of downgrades from AAA compared to what the market was doing was wee poco.
That much time.
Yeah, that's about all I know, but I don't know that one well. Yeah.
I don't know Spanish.
Oh, very little.
Okay.
Teeny. They would have like three downgrades. And I was in on that actually infamous phone call where the hedge funds are yelling at Moody's saying, you're just now getting to downgrading the security? The prices fell like 50% over the last 3 months.
Was that in July 07?
I believe so, yeah.
Have you got us that study?
It's a court case. I think it's probably public record now.
So can you help us find it?
I don't know if it's sealed or not. I would hate to go on record on a court case. Turns out it was sealed and I divulged it.
Okay.
I don't think so.
I mean, if it's not sealed, that would be interesting.
All right. I'll check. If it's not sealed, I'll be glad to send it to you. I won't be hired by movies.
So can you expand more on your views on the credit rating agencies? What is this? Is it people, tools, assumptions?
Well, I have somebody from Bear Stearns who'll probably... No, never mind, don't say a word. They serve a purpose. Although as time progresses, it's not clear what purpose they serve. But, you know, they have that two-sided issue facing them. On the one hand, they need business. They need to be able to rate products in order to survive and make money. On the other hand, they have a reputational capital. If they're always known as the soft rater, that probably works in their favor, but in the aftermath, it probably didn't matter. But again, I think the typical drill is you send them out to three rating agencies and you pick two to rate your securities. Which two do you pick? You don't pick the hardest one. You pick the easier one, or whoever lets you substitute in collateral of your liking. So they have a profit motive involved. But B, in terms of compensation, they're not paid anywhere near what the people are that are actually engineering and creating the securities over, let's not use Bear, Deutsche, or Merrill, let's say Goldman. The people at Goldman are always two steps ahead of the rating agencies. Just like they're two steps or three steps ahead of the regulators.
So it gets back to the skill set that the street gets paid more than the credit rating agency folks. So
they do, but Moody's, S&P, were actually out there trying to compete in the sense they hired some very sophisticated mathematicians, either as consulting or on contract work, to help them with these more abstract credit. They were doing it.
Professor, since this is for a historical record, I want to be clear. I did not do mortgages at Bear, and that I have in no way tried to influence greater or lesser scrutiny of Bear Stearns by the commission because of my background, and that your comments about Bear Stearns should not throw additional punches nor hold punches against Bear Stearns. If your views should not be influenced in any way by my stating what my background was.
Oh, trust me, they're not.
Okay.
So I'm sorry I didn't get through the data that you used in this paper, but
I don't know what you're holding up.
I'm holding the CEO implosion.
Okay.
And I guess the conclusion is that spreads more than back securities were sensitive to the growth of the CDO market. The CDO market grew led to a gigantic spreads.
That's right.
So do I interpret that to mean that the demand from CDOs as investors in MBS, lowered the price, lowered the pricing on mortgage-backed securities, which in some way stimulated the mortgage market?
Let me state this a little differently.
Okay.
In pure derivatives market, the creation of derivatives should not impact at all the supply and demand of the underlying asset.
Mm-hmm.
In the case of CDOs, however, there was an unusual twist. If CDOs were ultimately the purchaser of the underlying mortgage-backed securities, mm-hmm. that could actually impact the yields on the underlying securities.
Mm-hmm.
Stated differently, supposing we have an underlying subprime MBS product. Market is starting to cool a little bit. People are getting a little nervous about the MBS. The market could just die prematurely.
Mm-hmm.
But supposing that you're creating CDOs, you're actually creating an alternative market for the distribution of those assets. So they start going into CDOs. So in other words, what would have gone into a different fund, let's say BNP Paribas, buying direct MBS, they no longer are interested, so the CDOs are picking up the slack.
Right.
Okay, so that's a kind of a violation of what we used to know about derivatives. This is one case where a derivative-type product is actually impacting the supply and demand of the basis asset.
Okay, and some are cash and some are synthetic, but you're saying either way, because derivatives are involved, it's affecting the...
That's right.
Okay.
I want to go back to that, because I heard your answer to my question being... that because synthetics, in fact, didn't increase demand for subprime, they wouldn't have increased or affected that underlying market in contrast to cash CDOs.
Yeah, what I'm saying is it wasn't the synthetics per se. It was just the fact that during this market, if the demand for the base assets declining, let's say subprime MBS, CDOs as a whole, even cash, doesn't matter which structure it was, if they step in and start buying up the CDOs to place in these securities, that actually can drive down the spreads on the underlying security. But that's momentary. That's our whole point. This doesn't last very long. Because as the collateral continues to deteriorate, markets, I know I'm gesturing to her because she brought it up in the first place, the market sees a signal that it's going down. So that's a very short-lived phenomenon. I don't think that was a...
Wasn't it more than a year, though? I mean, if you count...
A year's a pretty good short term. I'm not talking about milliseconds. This isn't program trading. We're talking about... Yeah, it was about a year that lagged it. But again, the same argument applies, by the way, to mutual funds. Supposing that individual demand for securities is falling, mutual funds step in and start buying securities. Mm-hmm. Is that wrong? No. We're not having mutual fund hearings. Well, same argument.
Well, so first we decide what the cause is, and then we can decide if there's something wrong about it. Maybe that's just what happened.
Oh, no, I don't want to solve another mutual fund hearing. But no, but again, that's there's a difference between when you look at straight derivative contracts and these type of, whether it's mutual funds or CDOs, those do actually have an effect on the supply and demand of the basis asset. Mm-hmm. And again, so that's not gigantic, but can be.
Do you guys want to switch focus from the synthetic and the CDO world to the other OTC derivatives world? I guess the other group of issues that we're studying with respect to derivatives and how it could have affected the crisis has more to do with contagion, mm-hmm. which is just that the derivatives allowed firms to get more leveraged. There wasn't enough margin collateral required against derivatives, which was famously important in the IG case, but there's quite a lot of others. The sudden requirement of collateral was a problem because it was pro-cyclical and it caused a cash squeeze. These are some of the arguments that we're looking at. Where do you rank those?
Well, again, this happened when I was working during the I went through two crises: the Asian flu, which was the 1997. Mm-hmm. late 06, early 07. Then I went through the Russian credit crisis. Mm-hmm. But it was the same problem. We had an internal investment fund in which we had very small haircuts, meaning that you're all familiar with repos. Mm-hmm. So we would actually have very little equity in transactions. We would repo most of the purchase of securities, and turns out super high leverage. Mm-hmm. When times are great, the returns are staggering. When market turns down, it's a little tougher. My haircuts expand dramatically. Mm-hmm. But again, we had a huge balance sheet, so you know, we were in peril of that.
So who were you working for?
That's Deutsche Bank.
Okay.
Yeah, and it wasn't really a problem. But fast forward to the recent crisis. Was it lack of equity? Was it too much leverage? Well, too much leverage again is it bad or good? Mm-hmm. Again, on the way up it's fine, on the way down it's always a problem. Mm-hmm. Our banks were, as you know, now we're massively undercapitalized. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. What's capital? I mean, they're massively undercapitalized. So yeah, that's been a historical problem, and it's not. But you know, one argument can be made that leverage, at least by the investment or commercial banks, allowing them to engage in arbitrage through leverage, has a positive effect because it keeps the market going fast and furious, which means that they can actually, in certain market conditions, exploit certain inefficiencies in the market and keep the market honest. Mm-hmm. And I think if you're going to, if getting rid of leverage is a good thing socially, I would argue that I'd be very careful walking that plank. Because once we really start putting the hammer down on risk-taking, then we end up with very little risk being taken, which means that we'll end up back in kind of a 1950s world of financial markets. And I don't think we want to relive some of those times either.
I need to ask a question. Sure. That, because there is a literature out there that says if you make a bank increase its, or financial institution increase its capital requirements, it simply goes out and tries to take more risk in order to compensate and get better returns. I'm curious your sense of that dynamic.
Well, we're supposed to have regulators that that put the hammer down on that. But yeah, that's one of those interesting paradoxes. That goes back to my point. If I think had there been, not to keep repeating the same thing over and over, had there been proper oversight on Fannie and Freddie to begin with, which you and I have debated in public, that's why it's impossible to do that, and I agree with you after all this time. I do agree it's impossible to regulate them. But had they had proper capital and proper supervision, we probably wouldn't be sitting here today. Had the banks had serious supervision, again, this is not derivative related, but as I pointed out in something that I was doing with Bob, we were just pointing out that during the Greenspan-Bernanke merger era, we were letting all banks merge to the point where we created TBTF. Now they're too big to fail. Mm-hmm. All along, to this day, the Fed has rules on their books that say this shouldn't be happening. Mm-hmm. They have depository rules that say none of these banks should even be in existence right now. They should be broken up. Are they breaking them up? No. Is too big to fail a problem? Of course it is. It's a huge problem. Mm-hmm. But again, the rules are already on the books. That's why it was stunned with the Dodd legislation, saying, well, you already have these, just enforce what you've already got on the books. Mm-hmm. Somehow that missed the legislation. I don't know what happened. But.
So this gets back to one of your other points is we built this house, right? We built the demand for mortgages, home ownership. We also built the letting big banks merge to the mm-hmm. point that they're too big to fail.
Exactly.
And we've built the regulation that allowed them to use minimal capital.
That's right. It was, again, it was a all for, I wouldn't call it one purpose, because the credit card receivables market also expanded dramatically. Auto leases, gas station backed securities, got all over the place. Sailboats. That was a tough one to price, I got to admit. We tried doing the sailboat market, the resale market for luxury boats.
Right.
It was actually a security. As you imagine, as soon as the market goes recession, that thing is talking about liquidity drying up because there's no resale market for that. So the whole thing blew up. But, I would go back. We built this house of cards primarily on the back of the mortgages. And then we didn't regulate the banks. And again, I'm not a big regulatory fan at all. But if we do have rules in place, the best way to do is just enforce the ones we have, instead of building a new set of rules and regulations, which if we couldn't enforce the ones we have, how are the new laws going to be enforced? And that's the kind of the problem. I don't get how this is going to work.
So you've got another paper that I haven't given full justice to, on regulatory capital arbitrage. Mm-hmm. Could you just walk us through your views on, both that subject and that subject as a potential cause in the crisis?
Okay. And basically what we're referring to is that, in fact, we had to be very careful because my co-author there was working for one of the too-big-to-fail banks, Michael LaCourbe.
Oh, I see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so we had to walk a fine line in writing that one because he was still employed.
Uh-huh.
But basically what it is that the Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae's security programs are given very preferential treatment in terms of risk rating. So in other words, banks can hold a lot of Freddie Fannie securities, et cetera, more so than other types of securities in the market. So we've So that's the regulatory arbitrage. There's regulations governing what banks can hold and what they can't hold. And Fannie and Freddie are given preferential treatment, primarily, I would assume, because they are riskless with guarantees on the one hand, but as we discovered, the MBS may be true. But so that has skewed the market. And so what we're pointing out in that paper is that this gets back to the 30 basis point advantage. It basically says that the GSEs, Fannie and Freddie, contribute a whopping 30 basis point savings to households in the U.S.
Whose research is that?
Pardon?
Whose research is that?
That paper.
Oh, that's what you got.
Okay. There's another paper which is very similar in real estate economics, which I'll be glad to send you that one. Well, it's the same thing. But what it basically says is the following, if I can summarize for today. To get households a savings of 30 basis points, we've just created a staggering problem. In a cost-benefit analysis, I would say we got the short end of the stick on that one. I think most households would be glad to pay 30 basis points more and not have this catastrophic problem we're faced with right now with Fannie and Freddie. But again, that's because, once again, going back to the original premise, we have so skewed the United States in terms of investment towards home ownership and Fannie and Freddie with the securities programs at banks, because they really do have a big incentive to play ball with Freddie and Fannie. And that's why when I was testifying in the House of how do we get the banks back into the game? Right now, it's, I believe, 99% of the market is Fannie, Freddie, and the FHA. 99%. Is that a good thing? No, it's a very bad thing. That's when it goes to 100, I'll really be upset. But no, we have to get the banks back in the game. And part of the problem, if you're trying to undo the house of cards, is that... these are all issues. Do we still need massive tax subsidies for owner-occupied housing? Well, we back ourselves in what the economists like to call the proverbial corner solution. You take away the interest deductibility for housings today, and I'm already predicting a downturn in the housing market at the end of the year anyway. With all these foreclosures backed up, the tax credits have expired. GDP forecasts are not good. After the summer, it's going to be kind of cold winter out there. And so I don't know what we're going to do to start unwinding this. If you take away the tax deduction, property tax deductions, and those types of perk programs, that might be kind of jarring to the system. Probably should be evoked eventually. Probably gradual phasing out's a good thing. But we've done that, but again, just on regulatory arbitrage, we put in a system that if you, Fannie and Freddie are preferred, they're almost an endangered species. They're protected, the banks are encouraged to deal with them, hold their securities, and not actually originate and keep on balance sheet. So it goes beyond just the fact they have very little capital to invest. It actually goes to the fact that structurally they are encouraged to be Fannie and Freddie partners. And again, whether you like Freddie or Fannie or not, of that, you got to get the private sector back in.
So yes? I understand that if you took away the interest deduction, property tax deduction, that would reduce home ownership. I understand that. But I don't understand if there's a direct connection between that and moving mortgages from Fannie Freddie to the commercial market.
It's two different things.
Okay.
I'm talking about it would reduce the subsidy to housing is probably a good thing. We subsidize.
One of those subsidies really comes through Fannie Freddie.
Yeah, there's two levels of subsidies. One of them is just all the tax subsidies we give to encourage homeownership. We've encouraged a staggering amount of vacant property and oversupply. Okay, generally speaking, we pull back on subsidies if we've done that. Secondly, though, is another layer, and that's the Fannie Freddie subsidy.
Okay.
So we're actually encouraging banks to originate and get rid of, even if the private market comes back. So in other words, there still is this hidden kind of rule in there and regulatory arbitrage having banks originate to sell Freddie and Fannie. So even if we want the asset-backed securities market to come back, which I think is a good idea, done properly this time, mm-hmm. it's going to face really an uphill battle because of that built-in bias towards Fannie and Freddie and the banks. That has to be addressed.
Oh, do you have ideas on that, Brett? I'm sorry.
Can you get rid of it?
I need to ask whether origination would be different by a bank. Are you getting at a quality of origination if they're selling to Fannie Freddie versus if they keep it for themselves?
No, this is an excellent question. Fannie and Freddie, for all their revealed warts today, actually, for a while, had very good credit underwriting standards, which begs the question, what's the public purpose of them if they're only underwriting high-quality borrowers? Mm-hmm. I don't understand why we need a subsidy for that one, but that makes no sense whatsoever. We already have the FHA, which I would probably argue for shrinking that one, too. And again, it gets back to something I've argued before in Congress. The housing bubble, in addition to Fannie and Freddie and FHA, was down payment. Down payment is what, let's say, lower down payments to zero, you will get huge bubbles. When the market turns, who's going to default? Mm-hmm. All the zero downs, one, two, three, four, five, is going like this. Mm-hmm. Self-fulfilling prophecy. Did we know that in advance? Of course we knew it in advance. There's papers were written by me at the beginning of the bubble saying, do not go for high LTV. Warning, like the robot in Lost in Space. Warning, warning, don't do this. We did it.
Why didn't all of this stuff happen earlier then, in terms of you had Fannie and Freddie in the 90s? They weren't particularly well governed.
As opposed to now?
Shouldn't it have happened earlier?
It did blow up. Fannie blew up once already.
Yeah, in 1981.
In 1981.
Actually, 79, 81.
Yeah.
All right.
So we already had all the warning systems were already there. They've already blown up. Alan Greenspan testified in front of the Senate and said, I was watching him, as he was saying that this is very, very dangerous. But again, when you have a bubble, everyone's looking at the data, like no defaults. You're going, what's the problem? And Dwight Jaffe, our friend, kept saying, but if this happens, and everyone said, nah, housing prices don't come down. Although they have in the United States, more regionally. Like Houston blew up, Boston blew up. We've had LA had a huge LA. Explosion. Yeah, it's happened before, but we just kind of ignored history. But again, we push the system, and so the way to undo this is trying to defang Freddie and Fannie, at least pair them back. But again, going through the banks and making their mandate that they have to play ball with Fannie and Freddie for regulatory arbitrage reasons is probably one thing that could go. They don't need any more advantages. They already have a huge advantage in the market.
So you could change the regulatory capital requirements for commercial banks so that they don't get a benefit for holding the Fannie and Freddie guaranteed securities.
Yep.
You could require higher actual down payments, not 80% with a 20% equity line.
I've been all for that, and then when I testified, I got the usual the FHA people. Well, you have to have some low down payment work. Okay, fine. But it's regulated, it's on budget. We can see how much we're willing as a society to have 5% down. I think zero is a suicidal. I think it's a crazy idea. And I think probably Commissioner Stevens would agree wholeheartedly with one thing on that. But Fannie and Freddie in the old days actually had genuine 20% down mortgages. And I mean genuine because of we now know that during the bubble, you had people borrowing the down payments so they get to 20% so they don't have to have insurance. And it turns out, who is checking on that? In the old days, we used to actually check. They actually go through bank accounts. And that's kind of an efficient way to do it because you can always, if you want to, do that. That would require an IRS representative sitting in your house 24 hours a day to make sure you're not transferring assets back and forth. Very hard one to check. We used to do that. I think we kind of gave up. You say, did you is this your money? And people all said yes. That's fraud, by the way. But that was not a trivial event in the bubble. Borrowing your down payment. So you actually had 100% LTV, and everyone thinks you've got you have low risk.
Any data on that?
Yeah, I think Van Order and Compose are working on a paper on that.
Great.
Michael LaCourte Little, my co-author, has a piggyback paper. You've seen that one?
Yeah.
There's several papers coming out. Oddly, I was trying to get Fannie Mae to work on a paper on that with me, and they didn't want to do it.
But isn't Fannie and Freddie always going to be able to price better than commercial
banks? Unless you have I'm not supposed to talk.
the answer to that is, in theory, they have the largest databases. So if it's just sheer volume, yes. But the problem is that ex post, how well do they do this? Well, again, they've had an incentive all along not to price their insurance properly. The FHA actually has a better actuarial, or turns out ex post to be not a great idea. FHA actually has a more actuarially sound insurance model. Fannie and Freddie underprices their guarantees. So we're sitting here with what? Oh, massive bailout of Fannie and Freddie. Probably for a pretty good, darn good time. But again, part of that is you give someone a lifeline and government guarantee. They're competing with each other. What's going to happen? Answer simple. They'll undercut each other on the insurance premium to capture market share. Bingo. Market turns south. Who's stuck with it? All of us sitting in this room. So that's the other thing. If Freddie and Fannie are going to survive, they have to go through and make sure they go to a more FHA-type actuarial sound insurance model. I don't know whether we've got to do that, but Alan and I have spoken together on this, so we Tom.
You alternate calling me Tom and Alan. Who's Alan?
I have no idea who Alan Stanton is. I think he's a baseball player. Sorry.
Okay.
I promoted you to major leagues. I apologize.
Hey, so, I'll take it. Thanks.
So what's wrong with securitization? Is there anything that needs to be fixed there? I mean, the Treasury is calling for risk retention and more transparency. And
I've argued that that's another straw man. For the following reasons. It sounds good in theory. In fact, I take partly the blame for this because I was at a Fed conference in Cleveland several years ago and I uttered 5% to the Fed. And somehow I should stab myself in the leg for saying that. In theory, risk retention is a good thing, right? Piece of the action. Now here's the problem. We already had that. In securitization, to do a securitization deal, the originator already retains the residual piece, which is usually about 5%. Could actually be larger. That's generally about 5%. Now, Countrywide, as an example, kept all the residuals on their books, which are about 5% of the deal. You'll notice Countrywide is non-existent today. Here's why. Residual deals are the first loss pieces in the transaction.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is the skin in the game.
Mm-hmm.
When housing markets did this, how long did 5% last? Those residuals generally were wiped out within about 2 months.
Mm-hmm.
Bingo. The whole, and WAMU, all those, Wachovia, all of them did the same thing. They all had 5% residuals. So that's a myth that we didn't have as we did. It just didn't work. So requiring 5% sounds like a panacea, but again, all it's going to take is one more housing bubble hiccup, like another round of price deflation, and guess what? Wiped out instantly. So does that help improve underwriting? My prediction? Absolutely not. Won't do a damn thing.
One fellow at Countrywide said that they would hedge their equity position, I don't know if he meant fully, but largely, so when the equity tranches went down, you know, they were met okay. He said that wasn't a big
problem. And so they're out of business for what reason?
other reasons.
The heads didn't pay off.
Yeah, I wouldn't overread that one. That sounds like something from Countrywide. No, the answer is that yes, we would retain residual pieces, and we try to hedge the residual pieces, mm-hmm. and that's pretty tough. That's a lot harder to do than it sounds. But even if you have real retention of 5%, you're still going to be able to hedge the retention risk. Mm-hmm. And so that's again, that's just. I think that it sounds great in the papers. Why don't I, as I said sarcastically, so why don't we increase the 50% retention? That way, they'll really watch their underwriting. And so on. But that they won't securitize anymore. And I know that's. So you'll kill off the securitization market if you do that. It's not about the 5% retention. I think that's a straw man at best. It's going to do no good. It just sounds great.
I'm sorry.
I'm getting to a point. But go ahead.
So, I'm not disagreeing with you at all. But what we've heard is for the sieve structures, which I believe to be a relatively small population out of, if you look at all the securitizations, right, pretty small. But people will then say, oh, but the sieves were a big problem, and the sieves they didn't retain an interest in, or there was no equity tranche in the sieves.
Generally, there almost always was. I can't think of any.
Yeah, it's like 4% equity. Yeah.
And but so in some cases, people believe that the big banks did not retain anything in the sieves.
No, they couldn't in order to not have to report them as a consolidated and part of the consolidated financial statement. So the sponsors didn't retain anything, but the sieve itself had an equity tranche, a subordinated debt tranche, and then the but it's still highly leveraged.
Third-party investors.
Yeah, that's it. Third-party investors, third-party board, even though they were chosen by the sponsor, they weren't the sponsor itself.
So perhaps people have wrong facts, because it doesn't really matter. If the sponsor retains something, that's not the answer to consolidation, because the sponsor retained in all these structures.
Yeah, the sponsor can't retain anything and still treat it as a bankruptcy remote, non-consolidated SPE. You're not really spinning it off as a drone corporation then. Right. Now the assets in the sieve might have been, and probably were, issued by the sponsor, and they might have retained some risk in those securities that were then sold to the sieve. But that's a different issue, right? Because again, that's then because the securities are from a different SPE that was bankruptcy remote. Right. So, but it's. I think some people are misunderstanding the way the sieves are set up.
In fact, think of it this way. When we would sell a deal, one of the sales points of deals was that you show that somebody held the first loss piece. It was very mollifying to the market that somebody other than investors were going to get blasted if the underwriting was bad. Another issue I want to go on record as saying is that the fallacy of as an attorney, the warranties.
Oh, the reps and warranties.
The reps and warranties. That was, again, a noble idea that works in, if the market's working fine and there's a couple of incidents, but the courts now are so jammed up with reps and warranty violations because Countrywide, and I just shouldn't pick Countrywide, any of the ones that are being sued, all have, there's so much moral hazard. If you lost money on a Countrywide deal, you're going to sue them and just hope for the best. And it turns out Countrywide may have underwritten those things perfectly. The market turned down. So there's a lot of lawsuits about repurchase these. I've testified in these cases. They're horrible to sit through. But, so what happens is we're relying on those in the documents. You get the red herrings or get the any of the securities. It says in there a big thing saying if the originator... did not live up to their underwriting standards, that they will repurchase the tainted loans or make whole, et cetera, the remedies. And it turns out that was fine for small things, but when you have contagion, you've got this massive market crash, it's failed, didn't work. So I wouldn't rely on that one going forward either.
I need to go back to your sentence because of the digression. You said it's not just about the 5% retention, and you're about ready to give us the punchline.
Yeah, it's about underwriting. 5% retention does nothing. In fact, I would go so far as to say and I can feel the ghost of George Stigler behind me starting to put his hands around my neck saying, don't say this. But the lowdown payments, I think, actually was the thing that was the blast. I think once you open Pandora's box on the lowdown payments, between the 020 thing, the Kaposa, Van Order, and what Corlew are doing, once you open up that door, then it, again, formed a huge bubble. And if that wants to be our public policy going forward, hallelujah, move to Australia. They did the same thing, by the way, exactly as we did.
But the zero down brings in more speculators, too, and that's...
Yeah, flippers. I've got a paper that just came out with the first one. We compared Phoenix and Denver during this thing. And Denver, as you know, didn't really have a bubble. But we found out that flipping in Phoenix was a horrendous problem. And Denver didn't have much flipping at all. But it turns out, and if you read the papers, by the way, flipping is returned to Phoenix. Flipping on the foreclosed properties.
Oh, right, I saw an article on that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So why weren't people flipping in Denver?
Because there's no bubble. See, you have to have an underlying market that's growing for some reason. Denver just, you know, has very tight land use constraints, doesn't grow. Wait, Phoenix was just wide open west.
Well, it doesn't, I mean, wait, there was no bubble. It's a two-way cycle.
No, that's endogenating problems, yeah.
Right.
They're enormous.
So some of it's land use restrictions.
Some is land use restrictions.
But land use restrictions ought to be conducive to a bubble. Because you have money chasing...
No, but not if you have population restrictions moving into an area.
Because
you can't... If Boulder is finite, fixed on where you can locate, there's only so many people can move into Boulder, right?
Okay.
You can drive up the prices a little bit.
Right.
Now, Phoenix was just all over the place. Yeah. Same with Vegas, Inland Empire. All these were areas with lots of land.
Mm-hmm. So people have the concept that if you build it, they will come, and then you have speculators come in. And
how much?
They build it. Yeah. And
I apologize. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you.
How much did this? Do you think the structure of the subprime contract contributed, independent of the 5% down, you know, in terms of the 27.
Okay. I will go on record here. I think the most grievous error we're going to make going forward from today is that we're going to deny people with sensitive credit access to home ownership or anything else. I think it's going to be a fallout.
Wow. So it's just as harsh on the way down as it was exuberant on the way up.
Exactly. I think, while we gave way to store on the way up, we're going to be penal on the way down.
Right.
And that's my worst concern right now. So subprime is not a bad idea ever. It's not been. I wholeheartedly appreciate it. The problem with subprime was, again, low down payments. If you look at the data carefully, it's when the housing subprimes were actually doing great on the way up and even went flat. But when it did this, that's when they all. So they were more of a victims of the downturn. Because they also didn't have the wherewithal to withstand the massive turndown in house prices.
Yes, if you had said differently, if a subprime borrower that had 20% down had equity in the property and they'd been in it for even a couple of years, they probably weren't as at risk as a subprime borrower who got a mortgage perhaps at a later point in time, right, who had worse credit, who was still classified as subprime and had virtually no equity in the property.
Okay,
it's just a different type of borrower.
Equity in the property... I have a feeling that the answer to this is that there aren't very many subprime mortgages with 20% down. But if you have 20% down...
You'd be surprised.
Okay. There probably
were. And those are actually still... Van Order and I did some of that. I showed deals on Bloomberg with high down payment subprime. They're smaller homes. They're not, the, you know, they're not mansions. They're actually performing pretty well. It's the down payment.
Here's the story that, you know, I might... Hypothetical. You have 20% down. You have the 330 or 27, and house prices go down. You reach the trigger. Your mortgage rate, you know, goes really high. You can't pay, and the contract is predicated on you being able to refinance, or at least That was my understanding. Mm-hmm. So
I've seen this. In fact, when I lived in Phoenix for 2 years, I actually had a gig where I was not consulting. I gave a presentation to the organization about the whole issue was whether it's illegals or Mexican-American citizens. I gave a presentation to them on these type of mortgage products. And basically, and again, the same thing, I said, now bear in mind when you sign a promissory note, and I reviewed it, and I said, all the information's in there. If it looks too good to be true, it is. Nothing's free, etc. But it's a sort of common knowledge. When you read through those contracts, do I think anyone was... Were there small mortgage brokers that... Of course, I'm sure there were. Just like there's penny stock dealers out there that were, you know, call up elderly people, and people were selling inverse floaters to retirees in California. There's a lot of that. A lot of that's, I don't know, you know, illegal. You're not supposed to do it in the first place. How much of this was actually predatory? I think that's greatly overinflated. I think the problem came in. I mean, there were some instances, clearly, there always is. But I think the problem came as soon as you open the door to, I guess it's low down payment fixes it.
Low down payment and traditional fixed rate mortgages, not.
Yeah, but the like pay option arms are another. You know, right. I don't like them myself.
Right.
But then again, we argue we are more financially savvy than the average person. Mm-hmm. But I. For the most part, as far as I'm aware, it is very clear how pay option arms work. You don't pay down the principal, and if housing prices go down, or you lose your job, you're in deep trouble. I don't think that was ever misrepresented. You'd have to not read a newspaper. You'd have to not have ever go on the internet. You'd have to avoid reading any documents and just walk in to sign everything. Sorry, I'm not a big believer in that. Then you shouldn't be buying it.
Mm-hmm. I need to go back to your, say, take a secondary market perspective. Reps and warranties don't work, or didn't work at least. I assume you can police reps and warranties early rather than late, even in a bubble. 5% down payment didn't work. Countrywide kept a 5% piece on its securitizations. What works in terms of having a market that can protect itself from basically buying a bunch of garbage?
If I had to pick one thing, down payment.
You're talking the underlying collateral.
From the lender's perspective? Down payment, just like capital at banks, it's the same principle. Yeah. Capital cures a whole host of problems. This is called proper risk management. And there might be lenders who will go out there and do 0% down loans. Nothing prevents him and I from a private market transaction where I put nothing and he writes me a note. Probably staggering interest rates, which I would understand. Nothing prevents the market from evolving in that direction. But for financial institutions as a whole, they can clearly go through and mandate that there be, you know, for banks make loans that which have down payment requirements. Nothing in there. Fannie Frey shouldn't have been buying these things.
The inverse of capital is leverage. And before you were saying that leverage isn't necessarily a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
How do you square two of those?
Oh, from a household's perspective.
Oh, okay. All right.
They are not sophisticated financial managers. And they, as we now know, they will gorge themselves on debt and then kaboom.
Yeah, right.
I'm not saying that the government... knows everything and should dictate. But again, simple down payment requirements would go a long way towards alleviating a lot of these problems we faced. And again, back to Tom's point, if the 5% equity doesn't do anything, I think, again, had they had proper down payments, so the borrowers had stood to suffer, that's great. Transparency. Most of those loan documents were all available. I've seen. We used to pull them on subprime. We did some subprime deals. We pulled the files and looked. But that's when we were actually pulling the files and looking. We'd sample files, make sure they're all completed document stacks and all that kind of stuff.
mean like the actual mortgage application?
Yeah, sure. Okay. Yeah, more, and like Fannie and Freddie doesn't actually get, when they underwrite a loan, they don't actually get all the files. National City, for example, would send us the first five forms and say, we swear we have all the documents.
Right.
Did they? Yeah, sometimes they did, sometimes they didn't. But that's not what Fannie and Freddie screwed up. They were actually pretty good on that basis. But no, I think that as we move forward, we try to get securitization back on its feet. Again, you know, the bubble was created in part by too much capital chasing housing and too low down payments. If we don't make that mistake again, odds are we won't run into a lot of these other problems we're going to see. So securitization will probably come back, particularly if you get rid of Fannie and Freddie's omnipresence in the banking industry. It should work again. CMBS is going to be the one that's going to be the bear trying to get crawl out of the woods at this point, because they can't refinance their loans coming down.
So I guess we should probably wrap up. Can we get back to you again after reading through all these pieces of research?
Yeah, we need you're going to send along your papers. Yeah.
Okay, absolutely.
You mentioned five or six. I'll send you an email to remind you what they are.
Okay, absolutely. But again, just bigger picture, avoid the smoke and mirrors on the derivatives. Weren't really that big of a problem. It sounds good to the average person in the street. Those Wall Street hucksters, which again, there's some truth to that. It's not that they're all angelic flapping their wings around Wall Street. But I think the government created the mess in the first place. So let's take one step at a time.
Okay. Is there anybody you would recommend we talk to? Colleagues or?
I recommend Bob, yep. But you're already talking to Bob.
He's on the list.
Bob.
Van Order. Okay. He used to be chief economist at Freddie Mac. Mm-hmm. He's pretty good. You probably have talked to Andy Davidson.
Actually, I'm not sure we have. We should.
No, we haven't.
Andy Davidson at Andy Davidson and Companies. He's great. I would hire him at Deutsche Bank to come and do modeling for some of our more abstract securities.
Okay.
So I had enough problems on my hands. So he's very good.
Anyone else?
I'm trying to think of another academic with Wall Street experience.
Or vice versa.
There's always Calamaris, Charlie Calamaris.
Yeah, he's
a rather. He owned a bank that's
seized by the FDIC.
But
did it really?
Yeah, got seized by the FDIC.
Poor Charlie.
So it probably has some good war stories to tell you. Satya, can you think of anybody?
On securitization specifically? Mm-hmm. On this issue, Arnold has a different point of view than you do.
Arnold claimed
lob
a cruise missile at it and never let it see the light of day.
But he was a senior economist at Freddie Mac.
Yeah.
Where
did
you
like
was on
the
board of
the FHA? He and I don't. I won't do the quote. But he just claims it's just like one gigantic moral hazard problem in existence.
To securitization.
Yeah. I disagree with that. I think if you don't watch anything, it can go crazy. You actually have to have eyes watching things.
Were there any Wall Street firms that you know of that got it right in terms of the allure of the bubble? I mean, the more I look at the bubble, it hides incompetence, it hides fraud, it hides all sorts of mistakes by all sorts of players. Anybody that had a risk management system or a governance system or something where they were on top of it, they understood it, they said, thanks, I'm not going to play until dance until the music stops?
Well, I'll be honest with you, and my colleagues have done the same thing. I had my models all had housing prices in it, and we had the probability distribution.
Yeah.
And we all had this if housing prices fall. Most likely, best, worst, or district, whatever. We all had a distribution in there. The problem is the probability assigned to that downturn was so low that when it hit, because you have to use data to calibrate, right? If it is doing this, at one point you have to say it's gonna pop to some original level. But all the models were, again, just basically classic Black-Scholes. I mean, it basically prices the average is always growing, no one really had the, you know, end of the world type model. Even when they claimed Goldman Sachs, and again, I don't really like defending Goldman Sachs, but when they said Goldman Sachs knew the housing market was, well, they didn't know. They didn't know any better than anyone else. Again, but that could have done this, that could have flatlined. Mm-hmm. There's no evidence at the time it was going to do that. And so I think that's disingenuous to blame. And Morgan's going through the same thing, if you saw that. Morgan Stanley has exactly the same problem with CDOs, and they knew the market was going to go down. No, they didn't.
But if you misprice the original mortgage, which the CDO is going to magnify.
Absolutely. If you misprice, that's the error cascade. Mm-hmm. If you misprice the original risk, then all the other stuff's going to be mispriced as well. But that gets back to the fact that...
Some of us have another meeting.
Okay. I was going to say...